This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you know, we build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And as ever, we've been talking about the weather.
Oh, the weather. This is downright weird. OK, we've got the fire on, but it's utterly unnecessary. It's 12 degrees. You know, we're nearly at Christmas. It's December, northeast of Scotland, and it's 12 degrees. Downright strange. Good morning, I'm Mark Stephen, right beside me. The other side of a completely unnecessary fire here at Beechgrove, Rachel Stewart.
I've actually got my jacket on just because I feel you've got to because it's December. Uh-huh. But you're out here with no jacket on.
No, I don't care anymore.
And this morning I actually hung my washing out before I left for work. No, I did.
Seriously?
I think it'll be dry by the time I get home.
This programme's getting a bit domesticated, isn't it?
It is.
It's a little ironing before we came out. That's it.
No, it is crazy weather. It's incredibly mild. Will that be influencing what you're up to this weekend? We like to know your plans, so do get in touch. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the best email. You can text us 80295 or you can give us a ring 08085 92 95 00.
This week, we actually nipped out to Braemar earlier this week to do some stargazing at the night sky for next week's programme. It certainly wasn't as mild as this, but it wasn't as cold as it could have been either.
No, I was expecting it to be pretty bitter, but actually it was mild and sadly a bit cloudy.
Aye. Well, it came and went, needless to say, as we started to walk away from it. The skies opened. Anyway, coming up, I'm going to be meeting a farmer who changed the way he worked to improve soil health. And we're going to be hearing from another area that hopes to be Scotland's next national park.
Yeah, plus I take to the skies with the Cairngorm Gliding Club. That was brilliant. And as well as changing how you feel mentally, does the weather impact how you feel physically? We hear how the weather can affect people living with disability and chronic illness. First, though, the important matter of the mystery sound. Let's have our first listen of the day.
You know that thing when you wet your finger in a wine glass?
Oh, yeah.
You just go round the top and go...
That's what
I thought it was for a start. But no, no, it's not.
That sounds a bit mechanical to me, but who knows? Get in touch, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295, or I think it's Sky manning the phones this morning. 0885 92 95 00.
About a decade ago, Alex Brewster from Rottmell Farm near Pitlochry changed his approach to farming. He moved away from the more traditional forms of grazing his cattle and now really concentrates on what he perceives as being the health of his grass and soil. Now, this approach is often called regenerative. It's a phrase he actually doesn't like, but it's good for business and it's good for the land, he says. I got him to explain more about the farm itself.
We're 1,000 hectares, right. 2,500 acres, of which typically we're 130 hectares improved pasture, mm-hmm. So in decent kind of grassland. We've then got 200 of heather up in the top, which we don't really do a lot with now. Mm-hmm. Occasionally run some cows over it, there's a few grouse up there, and then the sort of middle ground is a mixture of kind of extensive grasses, bracken, rocks, and that's the landscape that's intriguing.
In what way? That's an interesting choice of words. In what way is it intriguing?
I think it's what I'd class as a kind of a battlegrounds, maybe not the right term, but there's a lot of knowledge to be gained in there. Historically, that was forestry, and it was harvested in about, I think, 1910 or thereabouts for World War One, and then was sort of put back into sheep farming in a traditional sense. And you know, it's been overgrazed, there's been big deer populations on it, there's a lot of bracken density in it now, and with what we're doing in terms of fencing and impact grazing, we're seeing a change in the nature of it. We're seeing clovers appearing, we're seeing plantain, native plantains appearing, we're seeing a greater diversity of grasses appearing from that animal impact on the landscape. So you know, that's why I find it intriguing, because it's a story in a chapter we haven't written or got out to write. We're watching an evolution of that integration of, which I think is, you know, the grass plant is thought to be 220 million years old. Well, it was the herbivores that created them, that's where the plant evolved, and here we are again trying to rehabilitate, I think, landscapes into the means of holding water, capturing CO2, feeding microbes, building organic matters, and all these things we're needing to do in the soils, which we've lost over the last 100 or 150 years.
Have you just essentially defined what regenerative farming is in that sentence?
It's a very interesting word, and I don't know.
Do you not like it?
I don't necessarily like being labelled by it. I think that what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand how ecosystems should work. In the reason we're regenerating is because we've done some damage in the past. We're trying to bring it back. And I think what we're doing is we're moving away from this idea that chemistry works to the understanding that biology is an awful lot better. So in a way, what we're regenerating is we're regenerating the life within the soil. And it's getting that soil system working, which is allowing us to regenerate landscapes. And I suppose that's, for the last 10 years, has been a journey whereby I was initially transfixed on what a more diverse grass lake could do. Mm-hmm. And because we've always been reasonably good at capturing data sets and monitoring performance on farm, when we got more clovers into pastures, we saw an uplift in lamb performance. The grasses were better and stronger. The interest went deeper then. Well, what's happening within the soil? Why are these plants working together so well? And I suppose that journey has just continued. And people ask, what is a good soil? I think our soils here are a lot better than what they were. When we started, the soils were hard and you had to squeeze them to let them open up, and the root depth was really shallow, and there wasn't a massive... It didn't smell like a deep... Mm-hmm. Earthy kind of smell. And that's definitely changed. But are they where they need to be? I think...
How much better could they get?
And I think we're still very much on that journey of improving and learning.
Okay.
So what I'm trying to do here is get into the base of this hole and find the sort of sub-base, subsoil. Oh yeah, that's good.
That is good.
I was like just taking this wee second down the side. Mm-hmm. That's the bit, that's kind of what he classes the money shot. Now, the first thing I'm seeing here is there's a fairly decent population of worms.
Yep, lots of worms.
Lots of worms of different sizes, reasonable colours, which is great. I mean, they are the soil's alchemists. They are the creators of perfect soil. Mm-hmm. And I love it when I can just put my hand on it and it just opens up and falls to bits. Mm-hmm. You know, there's roots all the way down through it. And what we find here is the root exudates leach from the root, which is feeding the microbes in the soil. We're actually changing that subsoil into topsoil. As these root exudates go down, the carbon source from the plant actually drops further in.
Exudates are what are exuded from the roots themselves. But what is exuded from the roots?
It's a root, in simple terms, it's like a leukoside. Okay. Or glucose, maybe. In a simple term,
sugars.
And that's what feeds the microbes. And the plants use that as a means of communicating with the microbes to say, here's my shopping list for the day. And the microbes sort of source it. And the fungi kind of source it and bring it back to the plant. And that's the communication system.
Yeah.
It's like fibre optics and steroids operating within the soils. Uh-huh. And as they drop down, so What then happens is the organic matter content of the soil, that by volume, increases because we're going deeper. Okay. And the energy stored within the soil increases.
You described this as moving away from chemistry towards using biology instead, saying biology is much more effective. What effect does this have on your balance sheet? Does this cost or does it save you money?
It means that potentially you'll pay more tax.
Seriously? Why?
Because we haven't got the input cost base. So what we're noticing is that the world has gone through COVID, and then there's been a massive upspike in energy costs. So the running costs, in theory, for the business should have increased exponentially, and they haven't. The biggest driver of energy into this business is from the sun. Now, if you want to wind the clock back far enough, the sun and photosynthesis was what created the carbon that we're burning today in fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. But we're just taking that at its original source, and we're growing pastures. So when the diesel price goes up, or energy goes up, or all these things move, it affects the business. But because we're not relying on that mechanisation...
You don't have the overheads.
We don't have the overheads.
Therefore, it pushes far too much money to the wrong side of the calculation, and you end up paying more tax.
Correct. So,
wow, that never even crossed my mind.
Yeah. So the theory...
How irritating is that?
Well, it's a wee bit. You're like out of the frying pan into the fire. But it's a happier problem to have. Does that make sense?
Yes,
so,
it does.
So I'm digging a hole and going back to the basics of it. It's the photosynthetic energy that I'm harnessing that is building this capacity within the landscape.
Alex Brewster from Rockmill Farm there, and we'll hear more from Alex later in the programme.
Yeah, interesting guy. I like the discussion about digging up the soil and seeing worms. When we moved into our house, there wasn't a lot growing in the garden. No. Nothing, really. Yeah.
Sterile.
Yeah, and my mum was saying, well, I think that's probably because if you dig in here, there's no worms. So we had to buy worms, and that made a terrific difference to the soil. And now we've got lots of things growing in it, but quite a lot of weeds as well.
When you've got intensively worked farmland too, you know, and Alex's farm is on the opposite end of the scale. But when you've got intensively worked, quite frequently there is very little worm action in there too, because it's so frequently worked, the soil is compacted. It's not a nice place for them to be. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the worms are the stuff we can see. There's heaps of stuff in there that you cannot see that's microscopic. Mm-hmm. But in order for the soil to actually thrive, all of that should be there. And the reason I wanted to go to talk to Alex, I've spoken to him before in a different context, and he talked about walking across his land and feeling the difference. It's kind of it's like a springiness, you know, in the ground underneath, and it's there.
Yeah,
it's there. It does make a difference.
You could feel that when you were
there. Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you another thing. I mean, you know, we've had this morning's not a good example. It's dry. It's very mild. We've had really, really intensive rain, you know, for a couple of weeks now, and the ground is saturated, lot of water. There's nowhere for the water to go, really. It's seeping out of areas that I've never seen water coming out before. I was up in sort of his hill, and it must have been probably 150 metres up above the river, you know, above the Strath. The soil was, the ground was dry.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I could have, I mean, not quite carpet slippers, but close. Mm-hmm. You know, you could have done that. There's absolutely no way you could do that with us.
No.
So there's something different there that's really, I suspect, his approach is really beneficial to the ground.
Yeah, interesting guy, and we're hearing a bit more from him later on.
Indeed.
We like to feature inspirational people on Out of Doors, and Anna Taylor fits the bill. Have you heard of the Classic Rock Challenge?
I have.
You have? Well, Anna from the Lake District became the first woman to complete this challenge all under her own steam, which basically meant that she cycled between the routes. She's currently giving a series of talks across Scotland. I caught up with her in Aberdeen, where she explained a little more about what Classic Rock actually involves.
Classic Rock, it's a guidebook. It's a climbing guidebook that was written by this guy called Ken Wilson back in the 1970s. And essentially what it is a compilation of 83 of what Ken decided were the best routes up to a certain grade in Britain. And they're kind of dotted around all over the place, from the south coast all the way up to the Isle of Skye. So what I wanted to do in the summer of, I think it was 2021, I hope I've got that right, I decided to try and climb all of these routes on my own in one summer, but cycle tour between them, carrying all my own stuff on the bike, which turned into an expedition about 2.5 months long all the way through the summer, and was probably physically and psychologically one of the toughest things that I've ever done.
That must have involved a phenomenal amount of cycling.
It was a lot of cycling, and prior to this, I wasn't really much of a cyclist. I bought the bike that I was going to use a couple of months before I actually set off, and I tried to ride it a lot in summer, but I'd never actually ridden with panniers that are the little bags that you put on the back of your bike, you fill them up with all your kit. I'd never ridden with those on before I actually set off on Classic Rock, and I had four of them on. It was really hard to ride my bike. The balance of the whole bike changes. So it was quite a brutal introduction, really, on the cycle touring front, and it took a long time to get used to. It's really hard on your body, harder than I really would have anticipated, but it's a really cool way to see the country, and it's something that I've done a lot of since.
Yeah, and is that what motivated you to do it?
I think so, and at this time, this was just after COVID had happened, so we'd been locked down for months. I just wanted to get outside and do something, whether that was cycling, whether that was climbing. International travel was just banned at the time. It was really hard to do, so I thought that it would be a really good opportunity to just see as much of the UK as I possibly could. And when I read this book, Classic Rock, and saw where all of the routes were, it just kind of sounded like the perfect route to go to all of the places that I'd always wanted to go to, climbing them, and just sort of function on my own out of the back of a bike in a really eco-friendly way in between.
So what were the challenges?
The main challenge was I was climbing nearly all of the routes solo, so climbing them without any ropes or safety gear. And this was kind of okay when it was sunny, because solo climbing is something that I've been involved with for quite a long time. I've done a lot of it on things that generally are much harder than any of the routes in Classic Rock. But the problem is, when the weather was bad, that meant I had to make the decision to either wait it out, which was obviously going to slow me down quite a lot, or to just try and climb the routes anyway. And solo climbing on wet, slippery rock, it's generally not a great idea. It can get pretty dangerous. It's when I was stood at the bottom of them looking up, and there was water running down the face, and it was misty and grey, and I couldn't really see 20 feet in front of me. There was definitely a voice in my head that was saying, don't go and climb this. This is a really bad idea. You're just going to get yourself into a situation that will get you killed.
And did you just do it anyway?
I really wanted to do this goal, and I thought that... I mean, when I say it like that, it probably sounds like I'm a huge risk taker or kind of adrenaline junkie. I'm really not. And in my head, a lot of it was, okay, I'll climb a couple of pitches, and if something really doesn't feel right, I'll climb down. Which I have done quite a few times in the past. It's possible when you're soloing. But for the most part, I actually didn't. Like, there were certain sections where things got really hard and really dangerous, particularly in small sort of corridors of rock. We call them chimneys in the climbing world. You sort of have to wedge your whole body inside them and kind of wriggle to make progress, and it's fine in the dry, but when it's wet, that can get really, really hard to do. So there are definitely a couple of epics, particularly in Wales, with things like that. But every route I got to the top of, it gave me a bit of a confidence boost for the next one, and then suddenly, instead of just picking off the really easy routes, I was starting to do some of the slightly harder ones and some of the slightly harder ones. And by the end of my time in Wales, I soloed a route on a cliff called Clwyd, which is the highest cliff in England and Wales. And it's got quite a reputation in the climbing world for being really easy to get lost on. There's not a lot of obvious features to aim for when you're up on that face. And a lot of people had advised me against soloing it for that reason. They just thought I was going to get lost and have an epic. But I didn't in the end. I went for it, got to the summit in about an hour and a half. And I was just really happy that the sort of wet rock climbing apprenticeship I'd just been through had allowed me to be able to make the right decisions on that face, and something that should have probably felt quite alarming felt actually quite within my capabilities. So it was really interesting in that way, and it certainly made me reevaluate, I think, what I was capable of.
How do you cope with fear, or do you even feel the fear at times?
I definitely feel fear, and I think that's a really common misconception that people make about me, is that I'm not scared. I'm probably one of the most scared people that you could encounter, honestly. Like, I'm good at controlling it in certain situations, usually when I'm on my own, when I'm soloing. But in other situations, I can get incredibly scared. You know, I'm scared of exposure. I'm actually quite scared of heights. I really can be, I promise you. And honestly, I've had some, you know, the amount of times I've cried on rock climbing routes, it's probably in the hundreds by now. But in some situations, I am pretty good at holding it together. And I think in situations where this... It is really serious, you know, you can't make a mistake. You know what you've got to do to get yourself out of there. I am quite good at holding it together, I think, in those moments.
One of my colleagues did the Coolin Ridge a little earlier this year, and she found it amazing and terrifying at times as well. How did you find it?
I found it amazing and terrifying. I would agree with that completely. So the Coolin Ridge, it was actually the final obstacle for me on Classic Rock. So 80... two of the routes are just standard rock climbs, you know, a few pitches of vertical rock. The very last one is the Coolin Ridge, which is not a rock climb. It's like 11 or 12 miles of essentially really serious alpine terrain. It's a knife edge ridge, there's loose rock. There are small sections of climbing and down climbing or abseiling, depending on how you approach them, but it's more of an endurance test really than a rock climb. And the day I did it, the weather was not great. It wasn't great at all. But by that point, I'd had enough of this round and I wanted it over with. I wasn't going to wait it out to find the good weather. So I just went for it. And I figured that, you know, if things went terribly, terribly wrong, there are one or two points where you could bail. And I would go for those if I had to. But in the end, it was okay. I just had to be very careful of my navigation, made really sure that I was in the right sort of parts of the rock faces for the abseils and the climbing. And it took me a long time, like it was probably about 15 hours or something like that, but I did get to the end, and that was, in terms of a finale, probably the best one you could imagine. It just summed up climbing in the UK. You know, the weather was terrible, you're constantly worrying about the situation you're in, but in the end it was just an incredible day out.
Clemmer Anna Taylor there.
She makes it sound so inviting. It is interesting that she has a fear of heights, isn't it? And quite a few climbers have said that before.
Again, it's this business of fear providing focus, mm-hmm. you know, of actually forcing you to concentrate on something, you know. And it's, I remember talking to a gambler once, an old friend of mine, who was a very serious gambler, and he said, if you couldn't lose, there would be no point in doing it. And I suspect the same approach holds true with climbing too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just feels like the stakes are quite high.
Yes.
Yeah, but I suppose it's the self-preservation thing. That would force you to make good decisions.
Yeah, but obviously, clearly, a woman of really quite extraordinary energy.
If you fancy some company when you're tramping in the great outdoors or keeping cosy by the fire, I'd love you to join us on the Culture Scene podcast. Every week, we take a burl around Scotland's arts and entertainment highlights and we hear from the folks behind them. Our guests so far have included artist Peter Howison, poet and playwright Liz Lockhead, actor Ashley Jensen, and Church's Lauren Maybury. If that sounds up your street, get the kettle or your wellies on and subscribe to The Culture Scene on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, she's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, we've got an art installation featuring sculptures of whale ear bones, and we hear from someone who thinks Lochaber should be Scotland's next national park.
And of course, we've got a mystery sound for you. Let's have a wee listen. So you don't think it's a finger across a wine glass?
No, definitely not. No. What it had that for a start, and then it moved away.
Mm-hmm. Come on, give us your guesses. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text us 80295, or you can ring us 0808 92950.
You know, the weather, we mentioned this earlier in the programme, the weather in this part of the world has been pretty grim these past few weeks. Very wet, very dark. You know, it's with the fact it was utterly relentless, it just didn't seem as if it was ever going to stop.
Mm-hmm, which is not something we're particularly used to in the East Coast.
No, that's for sure. It makes life just that wee bit harder.
Yeah, it probably affects your motivation levels as well, if you can hear the rain battering against
my
the
what?
Window before you even get up in the morning. But what about the physical body? Does it affect that as well? Do you feel affected physically by the weather?
Certainly, people with chronic illness or disabilities report noticeable changes in their bodies, as Helen Needham discovered when she spoke to writer and psychologist Louise Kenwood recently. Louise has put together an anthology of nature writing from the point of view of people living either with disability or chronic illness or both. Here they discuss one of the contributing writers who is physically affected by rain.
Polly Atkin is one I really enjoyed as well, and this is very much about the weather and rain in particular. Polly lives in the Lake District, quite a wet part of the world, and she comes up with this term, I'm not sure if she did or somebody else did, of human barometers. And this whole notion, particularly when you're disabled or have a chronic illness, how weather can have a huge impact on well-being and the ability to function.
Absolutely. And I think anyone that lives with illness, particularly pain, for long enough will notice fluctuations in relation to the weather. And so Polly has really explored that in great depth, and the kind of parallels with a lot of nature writing or a lot of mantra around there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing. When we are ill, we say we are under the weather.
Yes.
And particularly ill people, that really is quite literal, that sense that when the air pressure changes, or if it changes too quickly, or if it gets too high or gets too low, it affects each of us quite differently and we become quite sensitive to it. So to be able to track that is really, really valuable. And she references there was a project that looked at that and identified there's real science behind it too.
Yeah, it's interesting because Sally Huban mentions that as well with the wind. Shetland, she lives in Shetland, which is probably one of the windiest places around. But the different wind, depending on the direction it's coming from or going to, affects her in different ways as well.
It's incredible, isn't it? The sensitivities and again, that knowledge that we develop through these experiences, I think, is so interesting. And it brings a whole new layer of experience of weather and wind and being able to tell if it's an easterly or a southerly because different parts of your body is in pain or different joints are affected is a really forensic level of examination of the weather and the environment, I think.
Polly has actually written a book about Dorothy Wordsworth too, who was unwell for a good part of her life and absolutely hated rain too, probably for the same reason, because her body couldn't handle it.
For sure. Yes, Recovering Dorothy is a fantastic book, and I really enjoy how Polly relates back to Dorothy quite often in her work and how she talks about her work too. And Dorothy is one of the people who writes kind of quite early on around having bought the outside in. Dorothy adopted a robin who would come and visit her, and she bought plants indoors, and her bed overlooked the window so she could see outside all the time and could open the windows when the weather was fine. So that real sense of the connection between people living with chronic illness and how crucial and valuable that connection is with the outside world, but in ways that might just look quite different to what we expect from in the usual regard, I guess, for going walking or hiking or climbing, that it might be a much smaller, more intimate experience, but I think no less valuable.
Another word that comes up a lot is ableism. And actually how ableism is revered, that ability to walk and to climb and to get to the top of the mountain and to share that experience. And this kind of blows it out the water, actually.
Thank you. I'm so pleased. And again, it's only when you hear or read or experience a particular perspective that, again, those layers of ableism are revealed. And my own experience too, you wait to get better. That's what we learn. That's what we expect, is that you get sick and then you recover. And so when you don't recover, there isn't a narrative. There isn't a sense of what happens then. And I think this book and my own writing has come very much from that space of, as much as there's an absence and a loss with that, there's also the opportunity to create our own stories and our own narratives, the creativity that can be born from that, that does implicitly dismantle that sense of ableism, where there is an expectation that we will get better and then resume and reconnect with the world, that actually there's an awful lot that can be gained and can be learned from people who do experience the world in those in-between places of not getting better.
Louise Kenward there. And you can hear more of that conversation on the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available now on BBC Sounds.
The weather's an interesting thing. I listened to a good programme that Dr. Michael Mosley did on Radio 4 quite recently about the benefits of walking in the rain. Now, I accept that perhaps there are not the same benefits if you've got a condition which means that you're particularly sensitive to the rain or the weather really affects you. But he was saying that if you go outside in the rain gets rid of a lot of the pollutants that's in the air, so it's a good time to go for a walk. Yeah. And also there's stuff in the rain that could be good for your mood and also for boosting your immunity.
What stuff?
I don't know, and I knew you were going to ask specifics, and I don't know. A chemical.
Yes, but what chemical? See, that's quite interesting.
It is interesting,
I mean, trace minerals I could understand, but stuff that was blown up there. But if the thing is, if it's washing out the pollutants, mm-hmm. how is it hanging on to the trace minerals?
I don't know. This is a level of scientific discussion that I wasn't prepared for at 7.
You embarked on this conversation without really thinking it through.
It was a huge mistake.
Anyway. We've had some guesses in on wrong mystery sounds so far. Some of them actually quite clever. Denise and Phil from Abami, Rothes, same here, folks, says, where have you been? We've been awake since 4:15 a.m, waiting patiently for the highlight of our weekend, out of doors.
You know what's wrong here? That if you've been up since 4:15, you've had plenty of time to hang your washing out.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That's true. What have they been doing with their time? Anyway. Yes. They think it's aliens trying to contact us from the depths of space. Thank you for that.
Yeah, and they're off to a farmer's market near Archeston today. Lucky them, that sounds good. Mm. Alan Marks, good morning, Mark and Rachel. I'm guessing the mystery sound is a snipe, unless my ears are deceiving me.
Your ears are deceiving you, you know, without any question of that. Mark and Bearsden thought it might be the sound from the Aurora Borealis.
Yeah, we were discussing this actually when we were up at Braemar this weekend. We mentioned earlier in the programme that we've been stargazing, mm-hmm. and you thought that... Would we be lucky enough to hear the Aurora Borealis? Yeah,
some folks say they can. I don't know. It's an ultra-low frequency. It's hard to see how. Anyway, coming up, we've got Gliding in the Cairngorms, and we hear why Lough Aber should be Scotland's next national park.
Plus, of course, we've got today's mystery sound. Let's have a listen. It's quite hard. Craig Wilson, Gard Arnold's been in touch. Morning, guys. Great start to the weekend as usual. Heading up to King's House Hotel today for 2 days. First time in rebuilt hotel. Got engaged there 24 years ago in the original building. Going with the assumption today's sound may relate to today's programme. Very clever. Uh-huh. Rachel mentioned gliding. Is the sound of a glider wing vibrating in motion?
What's the name of that device in the glider too? It's the deedle thing, you know. As you hit lift, it goes, and as you start to sink, it sounds like a very sad clangor on the way down.
Yes, it has got a name. I don't think it's the deedle thing.
I'm telling you, I'm sure I saw a label somewhere that said the deedle thinger.
If you know, get in touch. Or even if you want to just have a guess about the mystery sound, email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295 or the number to call 0808592950.
As you know, we talk about birds a lot on this programme. Oh, the birds all around us. You can hear a robin singing in the car park even as we speak here on Out of Doors. So, we thought we'd try something new, and we've roped in a friend of the programme, Ian Broadbent, and his bird expertise.
Yeah, so if there's anything you've ever wondered about birds, like Mark posing a question a wee while ago about whether blackbirds hum...
Which they do.
We'll see. Or how do birds know when to migrate, that kind of thing. Can be anything. Anything you'd like to know, then get in touch with us, and we'll put your questions to Ian.
Drop us an email. You haven't got terribly long. You need to do it basically before the end of Monday, this coming Monday, the 18th of December. But email us to outofdoors@bbc.co.uk and we will put your questions to Ian and give you the answers in the new year.
Make them nice and tricky, please. That's what he's really looking forward to.
What is it in rain that makes you feel better? That kind of stuff.
I'm going to be looking that up as we speak.
Yeah, great. Back to Alex Brewster at Rockmill Farm now. At the start of the programme, Alex was talking to me about what's called a regenerative mode of farming. He's not just 100% keen on the phrase, but he told me about his approach.
There's a lot of time spent thinking about what it is we're doing. There's not a lot of time necessarily spent thinking about ag policy or subsystems or any of these things. I don't waste time thinking about that. It's not within my gift to control. And neither is the weather. But on this 1,000 hectares, I can do a massive amount to mitigate the extremes of that. And all we're trying to do is balance out these wet days and these dry days. So when it's dry, we've got root depth, we've got organic matter, we've got moisture in the soil, we're still growing grass, so we're still feeding livestock, we're still growing nutrition. In these soaking wet days, you know, we've got runoff, there's excess moisture, but we're not losing a landscape. So we can battle through them. Yesterday morning was very wet, we're here 24 hours later, you wouldn't think we've had the volume of rain we've had. You can hear the burns in the background, but the landscape, as we walk across it, it's not soaking wet. So we're trying to smooth out these peaks and troughs, this environmental, what I'm classing as an environmental resilience, which in turn has given us a financial resilience.
We've been talking about this from the point of view of producing grass to feed beasts. Would this pasture land be possible without the animals? Is it a virtuous circle?
Pastoral plants need to be given the time to express themselves. So, you know, set stocking doesn't work because you graze the plant to bits, you graze the energy out of it, the plant dies. You have to be very careful with the balance on farm that we don't overlook the animal because we're trying to get the pasture right. We have to find the sweet spot in the battleground higher up. That, you know, that is the intriguing space whereby the landscape's not as rich, it's not as forgiving, the animals find it harder. But we want the impact to stir up the biology in the soil and to mobilise that mineralisation and get these energy cycles moving. So we need the animals to do that for us, but if we push them too hard, it's detrimental to them. And that's where the management comes in. That's where the hours and the sweat and putting out fence lines comes in place to get the balance right. And so we're really sitting on a seesaw, continually trying to move our balance to find this sweet spot depending on the pressures that are coming at us. Seasons, marketplaces, climate, and all the time we're juggling these wee nuances to allow the business to operate profitably, to be environmentally sustainable, and to enhance our resilience to climatic change. And at the same time, and above all, we're trying to convert water, sun, all these natural resources into nutrition. And I think that's the biggest thing that gets missed in ag these days is we're told to produce food. But farmers don't produce food. We produce nutrition. And there's a fundamental difference between nutrition and food.
Okay, explain it to me.
As a farmer, if I was needing to bring input onto the farm, I'm going to look at the nutritional quantity within the feed label. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. And if you were feeding, you know, hard materials
to
the sheep or something.
Or the hens, for example. Ah. You know, we've got an egg business here, so we're buying feed for them. You know, It's the nutritional density of the ration versus the cost. Now, I can have a cheaper food, but I've then got poorer quality hens and poorer quality eggs. So I want a high-spec food, a good quality ration, a ration full of nutrition, which we've now got to be, I think, 95% Scottish, which I'm really excited about, to give us a high-quality, nutritious output. But people buy food on a financial value, they're buying the cheapest. They're always eroding away the value proposition. I look at food as a nutrition, and as farmers we need to produce nutrition, and the only way we can produce real nutrition is to get the biology regenerated within the soils.
This is clearly working on your farm for you. Have other farmers been to see this? I mean, how easy is it to try and convince them that this is the way forward?
I think farmers like eating with their eyes, so seeing is believing. So we have quite a throughput of people that come on to look at what we're doing, to ask questions, to interrogate, to dig holes and see the difference. And then, you know, they go away and they think, and it might take people 12 or 18 months to start the journey because there's that thought process. And the biggest challenge for all of us mentally is having the confidence to give it a go. But once people start down this track, you see momentum gathering. You see a bit of belief that this is working. Hang on, something here's changed. What's happened? Why has it happened? Well, that's exciting. And then they get a bit hooked and a bit addicted to it. And then the confidence within the farming system grows. And people start getting a bit more relaxed and probably more fun, but they're getting a bit more relaxed because they're not so transfixed on the operating costs. Because they're working with Mother Nature, working within the biological system, rather than working against it by applying chemistry. And the continual joke about chemistry is that when you put on a little bit, you need a little bit more to make it work the next time. And then the third time, you need more again, and more again, and more again. And eventually, you become the moron.
That's a nice line.
Yeah. And the more you put on, the more you need, the greater the addiction. Well, this is just removing that addiction.
Farmer Alex Brewster from Rockmell Farm there.
Yeah, I like that. You become the moron. Very clever.
Some very, very interesting ideas. And, you know, again, I was talking to a farmer friend of mine yesterday, Derek, and, you know, he says, because I was talking to him about Alex, and he says, but the thing is, if they drop using artificial fertilisers and things like that, he says, the supermarket shelves will be empty pretty quick. And I said, well, there would be less. He says, right now, arguably, it's not in balance. I was checking something the other day. When I was a student, there was less than 4 billion people on the planet. There are now double that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're feeding the vast majority of them, not very successfully in some cases, but, you know, is it supportable? Can we continue the way this is going? Probably not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting points to discuss. To get back onto Michael Mosley, we were discussing...
Oh, yes, the stuff in the rain.
Yeah, he made a programme called Just One Thing on Radio 4, and it's called Embrace the Rain. And I was saying that he was saying that rain improves air quality, right? It washes away this fine particulate pollution. That's what he says. But he says the rainfall also releases, and I think I'm pronouncing this correctly, geosmin, a fragrant compound which is linked with relaxation and increased serotonin levels.
Aficionados of the finer points of broadcasting will notice a phenomenon there where if you're uncertain as to how to pronounce something, you read it really quickly. Just...
So does that make things a bit clearer for you?
Yes, other than I'd quite like to know what geosmin is.
Okay, well, you were
next.
You were looking it up, so back to you.
No, well, I'm none the wiser, to be honest. But basically, it is... a metabolite. It's produced from things like fungi. It produces an earthy flavour in things like apple juice. That's what they say it is. So yeah, I can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
good here to answer all your questions.
Whether it helps, I don't know.
No. Right, moving on. Cairngorm Gliding Club has been going for nearly 60 years. As you know, it's located quite near Kingussie in an area of outstanding natural beauty. And the location means that there is a potential for lots of different flying. So ridge, wave, thermal, cross-country. You seem to be laughing there.
No.
Pilot Steve, you're going to test me on this later, aren't
no,
you?
No, I'm not.
It may come as a bit of a surprise to you that the club is struggling to attract new younger members who are willing to be there for the long term. I caught up with Nick Norman, John Smythe and Alison Myers.
In the early days we had perhaps 25, 30 members. Now we've got 40, 45 members. It varies a little bit. So we've increased in size a bit, but unfortunately one of the problems is we're all getting older. And so, you know, when I joined I was late 20s. Well, now I'm 67. So, and the people who are needed to make the club go, the people with the skills to be instructors, tug pilots, gliding inspectors, because we do all our own maintenance, those qualifications are quite difficult to get, and you have to, you know, spend quite a few years getting them. So the worry is that all the people with these qualifications are getting quite old, and we really need kind of new blood to come in and take, not just to join the club and learn to fly, but to train up to take on those relatively technical jobs. The trouble is there are so many other things for people to do, and it is a little bit time consuming. You know, you generally come here for the day, everybody has to help out, push gliders around, you can't just turn up, go flying and then go home again. So it is heavy on time. It's not heavy on cost, it's quite a cheap sport, but it's pretty heavy on time.
And it can lead to fantastic careers. I mean, that's exactly what happened for you, isn't it?
Yeah, like
you,
yes.
You came here, had a wee shot, and decided that was going to be a whole new career for you.
Yeah, well, I came up here in the 70s, and I was just hooked on the place. Not just the flying, but the place, you know, it is fantastic. And as a consequence of that, I sort of fell into a helicopter pilot cadetship with Bristow, trained to be a commercial helicopter pilot and moved to Aberdeen. And so that totally changed my career. I did electronic engineering at university and then I ditched all that and became a pilot because of gliding.
Obviously you love it, John. Tell me how you got involved.
Well, I'm a licensed aircraft engineer, was with British Airways for a long time, and a close friend of mine was a member here and he said you should come and check it out. So what I did, I came and I checked it out and got a few flights, and it's just such a beautiful place to be anyway. Flying in the mountains is just so impressive.
How do you inspire younger people to get involved? Because, you know, it looks quite complex to me. You know, could anyone do this?
Anyone can do it. You're allowed to fly solo in a glider at 14 years old before you're able to drive a car. And flying, the controls are actually quite sympathetic. You know, they're natural. When you feel them, when you have a shot for a little while, you actually start feeling the controls, and it's easy to actually control the aircraft. Takeoff and landings require skills, and there is skills to be had in the air. But all the time you're looking at the sky, your wind direction, all the different things. So it is complex, but it teases the mind, and it keeps you alert. And I'd love to see the kids doing it. We've had one or two young lads who've gone on to become pilots. One of the guys just now is flying for the fisheries. He's done really well out it, and other guys have gone on to get cadetships with the airlines. So there's people do it. It just, we'd like to see more people coming and getting involved and taking part. As I got my grandson to come up, and he looked at it, and he's had the tour of a glider, but he just doesn't want to do it.
Oh, no! Even with you telling him how amazing it is.
Yeah. He just looked at it, and he just thought, no, I'm a bit scared of it. I don't know if that's a factor. There's people being worried or frightened. I mean, how do they stay up in the air? There's no engine.
Well, I think young people generally aren't feared of that sort of thing. They're invincible. But I'm just going to say, not at this club, unfortunately, but there is quite a big junior gliding movement in gliding nationally in the UK. So there are juniors around, just unfortunately not at this club. And I think it's partly the demography, the local geography, that we haven't got the big towns or the university towns sort of that close.
But you do find that people come back, don't they? Or gradually they move north to get back to Glenfeshie.
Yes, certainly we've had a lot of people who've moved up into the... Well, obviously I'm one of them, I suppose. But we have had a number of people from down south who've visited here and ended up joining the club and ended up moving up here. And actually, we're fortunate that they brought with them the qualifications. So we've had three instructors move up and one inspector, which is great, but these people are all probably in their 60s and 70s now, and we do seem to lack new blood.
Yeah, so that the trick is getting them in, isn't it?
If I knew how to do that, I'd have done it. You know, and I'm not quite sure how. That's the problem.
My name's Alison Myers, and I'm an assistant instructor here at the Gliding Club, and I'm the safety officer for the Gliding Club.
How long have you been involved?
Since I was 19, and I'm 59 now, so I'll let you work that one out.
So you obviously love it. Yeah. What is it about it that you love so much?
I think it's different every time you fly. And it's, people talk a lot about mindfulness now, but it is something that you absolutely have to focus on, and you're not thinking about or worrying about anything else when you do it. So...
Can you remember your first flight and what that was like?
I can't remember my first flight. I remember going solo, which I did when I was 19. And slightly strange, really, because there was still a voice behind me. but very sort of freeing. And it goes amongst the sort of big achievements in my life, I'd say.
And what about this club in particular? Because you'd have to go quite a long way to get scenery like this, wouldn't you?
That's absolutely true, yes. We moved up from Preston about 4 years ago, but we've been coming here for about 30 years, and it was always a plan. And yeah, there is nowhere else in the country like this.
The club is hoping to encourage some younger members to get involved, and younger members who are willing to stick around, you know, and learn how to become instructors. How do you do that?
I think by giving them, and I think it is value for money. In terms of flying, it's probably the cheapest way to fly, apart from hang gliding and paragliding. So it is a cheap way to fly. I think as well that being an instructor, we constantly evaluate how we give people not only the best value for money, but the best value full stop. We do the things that are necessary for them and are going to help them. So it's very sort of individually focused. in terms of A, what you get out of gliding, and B, what we try and give you when you come as a member of the club. And having done it from being really quite young, it was a very good thing for me to mix with people from different backgrounds, with different abilities. So it's quite a good thing for young people, I think, because it gives them a real diversity.
Must be an amazing confidence boost as well when they're able to do it themselves.
It is. And, you know, through your life it gives you something to talk about. what do you do? I glide.
Your voices there of Alison Miles, John Smythe and Nick Norman of the Cairngorms Gliding Club. And obviously you can't go to the club without actually taking a flight, so stay tuned to hear Rachel taking to the skies a little later.
Yeah, absolutely fabulous. I really, really enjoyed it. And it does seem bizarre that something that's so much fun might struggle to attract younger people, but I think they do get younger people. You know, younger people are fascinated by it and they do come along and they will often learn how to fly and they do it really well, but it's just they then tend to move on. You know, they go to university or they find jobs in other parts of the country, and maybe they'll come back, but it's difficult to plan the future of your club on the basis of maybe people will return in the future and become instructors.
Because they don't have air cadets attached to them, do they? Because the vast majority of clubs do.
Have, yeah, and of course that's a sort of natural feeding ground, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now you're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. Right next to me here in the Beechgrove car park, Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, as we tell you, every week there's umpteen ways of listening again.
Yeah, one of the best is by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds. That means you can look it up at your leisure.
Indeed, or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, also available from BBC Sounds. Tell us where you listen to the podcast. Please get in touch with us with what David Weir did. He said, I heard the comment about access to huts in Scotland and Norway on today's show. Here in Finland, summer cottages, mokket in Finnish, have a similar status to Norwegian huts. It's true that buying one and then maintaining it is out of reach of many families. However, many are shared between a wider extended family or bought by retirees when they've more time and then shared with their children and friends.
Yes, he says some are the former rural homes or small holdings of grandparents who moved into the cities. As a Scottish Finn with a foot in both camps, I personally think Finland's relationship to summer cottages is a product of its own history. It's rather difficult to draw lessons for Scotland, where land ownership and usage patterns are so different and where population densities are so much higher. But I do think Scotland could benefit from a few more Finnish saunas. Love the show. I listen to the podcast version whenever I can. Keep up the good work. And that's from David Weir in Helsinki.
Time for the mystery sound again, I think. Have a listen. See, I was stringing electric tape the other day. Mm-hmm. Cattle fencing.
Yeah.
And the tension was such and the wind was blowing just the right thing and it was humming like that, but not just like that.
Okay, so you've not blown it. You're saying it's not that.
It's not that.
You've
not
got some wrong guesses.
Indeed, Lynn and Fife thought it might be a quail. She called it a button quail. I've never heard of them button quails before. Ian and Tully Nassel thinks, even stranger than the mildness this morning is that it's a clear starry sky too, not overcast. Actually, I was mentioning the fact that the robin was singing first thing this morning. The robin was really giving it big licks because it is dry and clear, I think. Mm-hmm. It says, is the mystery sound low-frequency whale song? Mm. Not as such.
No. Phil of Denise and Phil in Rothes have been in touch. I was mentioning that I hung out my washing this morning before I came to work. Mm. Phil says, good suggestion, Rachel. I did hint to Denise that hanging out the washing was a possibility, but she couldn't hear me over the noise from the vacuum cleaner. I very much like her style. You've got loads of time still to get in touch. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or give us a ring 08085 92 95 00.
Areas across the country are interested in gaining national park status have until the end of February to submit their bids, and we're planning to cover all of them on Out of Doors. Last week we heard bids from Glenafric and Loch Ness, another from Afric to Allerdale. This week we're featuring the Lough Harbour bid. Lewis Pate is a member of the National Park Working Group for the area.
Lough Harbour, as a recognised district, is about 483,000 hectares of land. The main communities within Lough Harbour total about 20,000 people. About half of them live in the settlements of Fort William, Corpach, Coole, and the rest are spread across that vast area. And there are settlements from Malig, Arisaig, out to the small isles, Rummuck and Canna are contained within that. You've got Neudart, you've got Spion Bridge, Aharickle, And then down to Loch Allen, Strantean, and Arisaig and Morar. So quite diverse and spread out across a vast area of ground.
Why do you want it to be a national park?
So I've lived and worked here for about 15 years. Prior to that, I worked at Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park, and I currently, part-time, I'm working at Cairngorms National Park. And it draws some very interesting comparisons. When you travel between Cairngorms National Park and Loch Aber, you start to see quite a lot of differences. Now, I'm also director of Nevis Landscape Partnership. It's a volunteer board position. And we are a small charity based here in Glen Nevis. Mm-hmm. We were standing looking at the south side of Ben Nevis, Britain's highest mountain, which I think is on its own probably a quite a strong justification for looking at how we protect and manage that area more effectively. So the Nevis Landscape Partnership, we're not state-funded. We get our funding from various sources, and we have been working in and around Glen Nevis for about 20 years. But what I see and what frustrates me hugely is the lack of resources and joined-up thinking. So we don't really have a proper integrated land management approach in Loch Aber. There's lots of people doing good stuff, lots of communities doing good stuff, and developing their assets and their thoughts and how they do things. But what happens in a national park is very, very different. You've got a facilitator. You've got significant, sustainable resources coming in, which in itself attracts good people. So you bring in good knowledge. You bring in a convening power that can tie a lot of those interests together and make them very much more effective.
So what difference would that make to people living and working in the Loch Aber area? Would the place look any different?
I think that's probably a misconception that many people have, and one of the things we've tried to do, we've formed a working group and we've been going out to local communities and trying to just communicate what a national park actually is. What does it do? How does it function? Is it going to stop me putting double glazing in my house? Is it going to make the place look completely different than it did before? And I think the answer to most of those questions is no. But what it's going to do behind the scenes is just bring people together, bring public bodies together, public agencies together, the business community maybe slightly together as well, and just provide that conduit for making things work a bit more efficiently. We attract significant visitor volumes here. Now, that does two things. It brings money into the local community. You know, it's the basis of the economy here predominantly. We've got big industry. We've got Jahama. We've got the smelter. We've got the sawmill, but tourism is the main driver, certainly, through most of the year, and brings resources to the local area, supports local businesses. But it also brings a huge level of impact onto the environment. So footpaths, fences. We've got massive pressures in Ben Nevis, over 300,000 people a year climb Britain's highest mountain. If you look at Snowdonia and Scafell Pike, they both sit within separate national parks south of the border. So I think it would bring additional resources, a bit of joined-up thinking, and a lot more support for local communities to empower them and maybe develop their own assets. We've already got significant community-owned assets in Loch Aber. We've got the Egg Heritage Trust, we've got Noidart, and we've got other smaller community groups around the place. And there is a national push to create more community-owned assets within Scotland, and I think a national park could facilitate that process.
If this were granted national park status, would I be correct in thinking that essentially you would then have a national park that would run from the Atlantic all the way across the other side of the Cairngorms Massif?
Yeah, pretty much. Currently you've got two existing national parks in Scotland. They were created 2002, Loch Lomond and Trossachs, 2003, Cairngorms. Loch Lomond and Trossachs, they all have similar population densities or population numbers around sort of 19,000-20,000 people to Loch Aber, just to draw a simple comparison. The size of them is quite different. So Loch Lomond and Trossachs, 118,000 hectares. Cairngorms National Park is huge. It's 450,000 plus hectares. Loch Aber is 483,000 hectares. If you joined all of that together, not only would you join the Cairngorms Plateau to the Atlantic rainforests of the West Coast, but you would create and designate over 1 million hectares of national park in Scotland. Now, that could deliver on people and climate and biodiversity priorities for Scottish Government very much more effectively.
being a national park, does it necessarily mean you're going to get more money? Because everybody's broke at the moment.
So public sector spending, if public sector budgets are going to contract next year, they'll probably contract for national parks. The budgets of national parks currently sit around £14 million, £14.5 million in Scotland each. I'm not suggesting in a new national park would happen immediately. It would be an evolutionary process. We might start with a few million and then it would be up to the park board and the park staff to generate more funds. But one thing parks are very good at is taking that money and turning it into lots more money. And currently, going back to my original frustration travelling between the areas, is we don't have that just now. And I would like to see a share of some of that brought to Loch Arbour so that we could put it to good use.
Lewis Pate there of the National Park Working Group for Loch Arbour. And we'll be back featuring more of the areas vying for that national park status in the new year. Noise pollution in our seas is the focus of an exhibition taking place in Edinburgh just now.
Yes, ceramicist Mela Shaw is deeply concerned about the impact of the increasingly noisy sea on cetaceans.
Helen Needham met her at Summer Hall to discuss her exhibition Sounding Line. She explained how a particular event in the Hebrides prompted her to investigate further.
Almost exactly 5 years ago, there was a mass beaching event where over a 2.5 week period, over 100 whales were washed up dead all over the west coast of Scotland, in the Hebrides particularly, the coast of Ireland and also Iceland. The species that were affected were all deep diving beaked whales, and one particular species called the Cuvier beaked whale was massively affected. So I think 45 of the whales that were washed up were counted as being Cuvier beaked whales. It's a species that dives very, very deeply, and we actually don't know very much about its behaviour because it happens so deep. They're really highly evolved to come up for air and then go back down to a great depth and do most of their feeding and hunting there. But something was happening to cause them to come up very, very quickly. So the autopsies that were done on the beached whales that were washing up, you could tell that they had nitrogen poisoning, so they had got decompression sickness or the bends. But because they're highly evolved not to get the bends, something must have caused them to really, really panic and come up far too quickly. And it was that information that the Scottish Marine Animal Stranding Service used, basically through those autopsies, to work out that it was probably sonar that was causing this. And then over the intervening years from that mass beaching event 5 years ago, they've pieced it together that indeed it does seem to be sonar particularly, but also other sound pollution caused by ships that's causing these whales to panic. It's also because the whales are often in the wrong part of the sea or new parts of the sea, and that's because of other changes caused by climate change, so things like the sea temperature. So their feeding and mating patterns have all changed, which means they're often in the wrong area, part of the sea that they wouldn't normally have been affected by the sonar. They are being affected, so it's all interconnected, really. We're really polluting the sea in this new way. It's an ecosystem that doesn't have boundaries. It's always moving, and therefore anything that happens has a knock-on effect.
What are these sounds like? Because you've incorporated that into your art, haven't you?
Firstly, they're extremely loud. The beaked whales use echolocation to navigate and to communicate with each other, and also to keep a distance away from objects and things, and also to hunt. But for them, the sonar just interrupts that totally. So it's like being bombarded by a cacophony of sound. And also sound dissipates quite quickly in air, but in the sea, the water holds the sound for much longer. So apparently sound can keep being around for sort of weeks or even months. The same sound can kind of ricochet. So we've got layer upon layer of sound that's just interfering with their natural habitat. For them, presumably, I mean, they have no idea where it's coming from or why, obviously. So it's extremely confusing, yeah, and what it means. And I think, obviously, for them, it just must be danger. So that's why a lot of the species are obviously panicking and coming up for it very, very quickly.
You're a ceramicist. Do you want to describe what you've done?
right at the very beginning, I had this idea to use some actual bone from a beached whale, because not everyone knows, but bone china is actually made using real cow bone. It's about, lots of people don't know that. So it's about 40 to 60% cow bone in bone china. And I thought, oh, well, you know, maybe I could use the bone of a beached whale and kind of really draw to our attention that whales are mammals and they're like us in many, many ways. You know,
they have
live young, just skeletally, if you look at the skeleton of a whale, it's so similar. Their fins look like hands, you know, it's very evocative. So I thought, okay, if I could somehow get some whale bone and turn it into a clay body, I'd like to make some forms. I had to get permission from Nature Scotland. So I have permission to use just one specific whale, which was a northern bottlenose whale, and I got the bones from that whale. And then I had to sinter the bones, which just means fire them in a ceramic kiln to 1,000 degrees. And then basically at that point they become bone ash, so it's going to calcium, so you can just grind it up. And then I added that to a clay body. And what I have ended up making, they are quite hard to describe, actually.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have a sense of citation about them, but it's more specific than that, though, isn't it?
So I did a lot of research in various zoological museum collections and looking at the many, many different ways different species of whales hear. Because they're mammals, they have inner ear bones, you know. The bones that I've based these on are only 2 centimetres long in real life. They're absolutely tiny, and I've blown them up to kind of, they're around a metre square, and some of them are a bit smaller as well. I wanted them to be very mysterious and a bit ambiguous, but quite bodily as well. Yeah. And part of that comes from the experience I had. I got to actually go to the Hebrides, and extraordinarily, in South Uist, I found a dead beached minke whale on the sand, and then just a few metres away, its complete skull as well. So really incredible moment. But one of the overriding feelings that I had was of this kind of otherness about it, this really incredible, totally beautiful, majestic animal in its natural habitat in the sea, is suddenly completely redundant on land. I wanted to get that sense of otherness in the object. And then they're wrapped in rope. So the rope that I've used is actually marine rope, and it's quite a vivid red. And I've worked with another artist called Theodore Kosovoz to get the sound of these shipping sounds and also sonar sounds through the rope in a pulse. So the idea being that you hold the rope that's wrapped around the forms, and through the rope you feel the vibration in your body, which is how echolocation works for the whales. And the kind of confusion of it, hopefully, is something that the visitors experience very physically rather than just intellectually. I want to kind of draw attention to a much bigger issue, and this sense of sort of the whale being seen as a kind of harbinger of doom. It's been used in art history quite often, but particularly in Dutch and Flemish sea and landscape etchings in the 17th century. They used to have a kind of an image of a beached whale, and it was seen as, like I was saying, the kind of othering, almost like the reversal of God's order, and this sense that if a whale was beached, then basically everything had to stop, and then, you know, decisions were reversed, that were laws that were being made at the time were reversed, because it was seen as like, this is such a doom-telling prophecy to have a beached whale. And it feels like right now, at this time of climate crisis, basically trying to say we have to do something to correct this.
Mela Shaw speaking to Helen Needham there about our exhibition Sounding Line, which is on at Summer Hall in Edinburgh until the 25th of February. As well as a ceramic installation, she's also created a film which shows her returning one of her unfired pieces to the sea in the Hebrides. You can also see that at Summer Hall, or take a look at our website, melashaw.co.uk.
It's suddenly got incredibly windy sitting here. The sparks
it's
are flying out
very,
of that fire.
Very easy. Yeah. So I saw an image of those porcelain pieces, etc., hanging from ropes, you know, from the, you know, the Red Island ropes from the ceiling. Those bones that contain within the whale's ears, whalers used to take those and paint them to either look like sort of babies or fetuses or things like that. And I think there's a couple of examples of it that used to be in the Arbuthnot Museum in Peterhead.
Ah.
Very odd looking things.
Yeah, looking at those images, they almost look like giant teeth, I think, yeah. Hanging from a rope. Yeah, they're quite interesting. And I think it is interesting as well that there's bone in bone china. It sounds so obvious. But unless you kind of properly make the connection, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. It's bone ash, isn't it, that they use, and that gives it that sort of white, glossy appearance.
Yeah, I think so. But certainly, you know, the accounts of the whaling, you know, fleet coming back into harbour, because essentially, you know, they took the whales to pieces, they to see, you know, brought it back in. But the smell, they would know they were coming, depending on the wind direction, they'd know they were coming before they could actually see them.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, moving on, earlier in the programme, I spoke to some of the members of the Cairngorm Gliding Club. Well, you can't go there, can you, without trying your luck for a trip out. It was a wet, misty day. In fact, it was lashing rain all morning, and I thought, this is not going to happen. But we finally got a break in the weather, and I was able to take to the skies with pilot Nick Norman. So there's a rope attached to a vehicle, and it's just pulling us gently along the airstrip so that we can get into position. Pilot Nick is about to hop on board.
So before we take off, we just prepare the aircraft for takeoff with some checks, so just to make sure the aircraft's correctly configured. Check your straps are okay in the back.
Yes, we feel quite secure.
The instruments are all on and set correctly. And you hear that? There's a bit of a beeping noise goes on, and it's called a variometer, which tells us whether we're going up or down. So when it's beeping, it means that we're going up, and it beeps more frantically the faster we're going up. And could we do a cable release check, please, yes, Alison? So at this point, I always say, what could possibly go wrong now? Because if I don't say that, I'm sure something bad would happen. But I said it, so we'll be all right. So there's the tug taking up the slack now. And somebody's holding the wings level for me. So any minute now, it's going to open the throttle and we'll go trundling off. There we go, starting to open the throttle now. It's a little bit clunky, as you can hear on the undercarriage, but that's just the way it is. So I have to keep the wings level now because the person holding the wingtip can't run this fast. We're doing about 40 miles an hour. And so shortly, we should get airborne. Now we're airborne, and you can hear the clunking stop because now we're flying. But the tug's still on the ground, so I have to just wait for the tug to kind of get airborne. And he'll start to climb, and we're just going to sit behind him.
How high up are we just now, do you think?
Well, above the airfield, we're 900 feet. No, we're still climbing behind the tug. It's really about the height over the ground, you know, when you're in the mountains.
It's amazing. A fantastic view.
Yeah, you can see ahead. Slightly left, it's a bit grey. That's a bit of a rain shower there, but it probably won't reach us because the wave tends to kill them. So if you look to the right there, you can see the Inch Marshes. Straight ahead is Gingussie, slightly left of the nose. Can't see too well because of the haze is Newton Moor. And there's Loch Inch on our right wing tip. So I've released from tow now. I'm going to put the undercarriage up. There's quite a big plonk when I do that. There we go. And I'm going to slow right down now, so it's a bit less noisy. We're just climbing very slightly. I hear that beeping still.
And I can see the tug plane taking off away to our right.
Yep, he's going back to the airfield now. So that we towed to just over 2,000 feet there. But I've been flying here for 45 years, and you know, you still look at the scenery and go, wow, you know, quite lucky to have this as my sort of playground. It's fantastic.
Have you noticed many changes in the 45 years?
Oh, massively so, yes. So when I first came here in the late 70s, it was all about the skiing, and so out of ski season, Aviemore was deserted. And of course, Aviemore was a tiny fraction of the size that it is now. Whereas now it's all about the whole outdoor experience, the hill walking, the mountain biking. And Aviemore is constantly busy 365 days a year. And of course, it's grown massively.
And have you noticed anything else in the landscape? But you know, obviously there has been a lot of tree planting in recent years.
Yeah.
Can you see evidence of that here?
A little bit. Obviously, further up Glenfeshie is Glenfeshie Estate, which is owned by Anders Paulson, and he has this rewilding project where the idea is instead of having deer that eat all the saplings, you just let the saplings grow naturally, or you even plant some trees. So I think the answer is yes, although mostly lower down. The sort of heights that we tend to be when we're gliding is sort of above the tree line. So you don't tend to notice that so much, but yes, there's certainly been a change. You see far fewer deer is one change.
Yeah, so you see fewer deer. What about eagles? You must get a fabulous view of them up
certainly
here.
A lot more eagles. All the big birds, the eagles, the buzzards, the osprey. And of course, what's good about them is they're better soaring pilots than I am. So if you're looking for a thermal and you see a bird circling, that's where to go, because that will be going up. And they've always found the best thermal. So
follow the birds.
Follow the birds, definitely, yeah. And it's funny, actually, they sometimes get a bit aggressive. There's a bit of a sort of hierarchy in birds, I think. So big birds expect little birds to be subservient to them. So if you're the eagle, well, you know you're the biggest bird around. And so sometimes they don't quite realise that you're quite a big glider far away. They think you're a little glider quite close, and they make a bit of a dive at you. And then when they get close, they go, oh, hang on a minute, this guy's quite big.
I'll back off a bit.
I've had a few of those where they've sort of extended their talons in a dive and then broken off when they realised that wasn't a very good idea. I think I'm going to go back onto the hills there, and we can have a close look at some heather and rocks.
It is amazing that we are 2,000 feet in the air and there's no engine. You know, it does blow my mind a bit.
Yeah, it's that's good, because when you've got an engine, the engine can fail, and then you've got a problem. And, you know, you've got fuel on board, so gliding's actually very safe, because I would be in places in this glider that I would be quite nervous about being in a powered aircraft, because if the engine fails in a powered aircraft, you can't glide very far, and you know there's nowhere to land. So whereas in a glider, you can glide. You know, we can easily glide to Aviemore from here. So you see, what we're doing now is flying quite close to this hill, and the wind's blowing onto the hill, and so we're climbing a little bit slowly at first, because it'll get better once we get a little bit higher. So I'm just beating to and fro on this hill in the wind that's blowing up the hill and rising. And you may think we're quite close. Well, we are moderately close, but not that close, because it's so featureless and there's no trees. It's quite difficult to sort of judge how far away you are. But if you see people, you know, that kind of puts a scale on it, and you'll see that actually we're not that close, really.
Yeah.
You hear the Vario's beeping now. We've got a bit of stronger lift now. I think on the next pass we'll probably climb quite well, because the wind will be a little bit stronger. There's a glider up there above us, just to the left.
Yeah, I can just see the glider beside us just now.
And there's another glider on the nose now, just coming into the... So you see what I mean about gliders tend to congregate where there's lift. So keeping a good lookout is really important, and actually you can help with that by keeping a good lookout for me. And if you see another glider, then you can tell me, just in case I haven't seen it. I'm just going to fly up. Well, actually, on our left there, you can't see it because of the cloud, it's still gooey. And behind that is Loch Einic.
The ground
drops away to quite a sort of... I don't know if you're familiar with the local area, but it's quite a sort of harsh granite sort of gash in the mountain with a lock at the bottom.
Beautiful, really beautiful. I think it allows you to see the hills from a unique perspective.
Yes, yeah, certainly. It's interesting. I took a walk up the hills a few weeks ago. It looks completely different from ground level. I was trying to work out where I was. I know this area extremely well from the air, but from the ground, I was really struggling to work out where I was. So we're doing about 100 miles an hour over the ground at the moment, which is not bad for no engine. So we're going to be able to get from Glenfeshy to Loch Inilin in just 2 or 3 minutes at 100 miles an hour. And we're still only coming down about 100 feet a minute, 200 feet a minute.
It doesn't feel like we're doing 100 miles an hour, does it? It still feels
very smooth. We're doing 95 knots, which is we're doing about 105 miles an hour now. So we're down to about 200 feet now, and just open the air brakes to get us comfortably in. That'll be a little bit of a float. And then when the wheels touch, they're all rattly clonky, but that's sort of normal. Here we go, just raising the nose to round out. And it's going to land any minute now, he said, hopefully. Oh, there it goes. And I've got to turn off to the left. There's somebody else coming in
That was very smooth, Nick.
No, it wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
I've done better, actually, because it did bounce slightly. Oh, I'm just going to jump out because there's another glider coming in behind us and I need to clear of the runway. So just hang on a second.
Many thanks to Nick Norman, all at the Cairngorm Gliding Club. It was fabulous. Really, really enjoyed it.
I really enjoy gliding. Any time I've ever done it, I've had a lovely time with it.
Yeah, and Nick is such an experienced pilot that you felt completely safe.
Yeah. I went out with a guy once, Chris Rawlings, who was the chief instructor for the British Gliding Association, and out of a Boeing, and we got up to 16,500 feet. There were military jets passing underneath us.
Oh, that's
that was
pretty
very
cool.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, very cool. Cool. Yeah. Time now to reveal our mystery sound. Let's have our final listen.
We'll do a few wrong ones first. Debbie, Cameron, Lacey and Amber the dogs say, is it the spirit of Ewan McElraith coming to check up on you all and wish you a happy Christmas? Off to muck at a horse by torch. Bring on the winter solstice. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
David John Chadwick in Carluke says, morning all. Definitely a day for getting our waterproofs on before we take our dogs for a walk. I think the mystery sound is wind blowing over a wire or through an electricity pylon.
Good guess. David Long from Spottiswood said, is the mystery sound one of the many drones around in our skies? And John McKenzie in Orkney says, is it a hydro phone recording of a boat engine? That's very, very close, John, actually.
Someone who hasn't given their name says, is it trying to find out of doors on an old wireless set? Veronica from Kelso says, the mystery sound is elephants communicating with infrasound, transmitting it through their feet into the ground.
I've heard recordings of that. Heather from Linlithgow says, is the mystery sound a whale's ear bone? And Walter in Inverness says, sounds like my cat when he has a mouse and has just shown me his prize. He makes that sound when I try to get him away from the mouse. Yeah, ours does that as well, actually.
Jake from Dalkeith, is it a fish, maybe a salmon? And Rick in Cumbria, is it the noise you hear when you press your ear to the trunk of a Scots pine tree?
Oh, these are all very good guesses, but they're not quite correct. It's actually, to be honest, it was extremely difficult, and we kind of blew the gaff in that last piece by Helen, because essentially it's an underwater recording of the sounds pollution makes in the ocean by sound artist Theodore Kotovas, and it was used in that exhibition, Sounding Line.
Yeah, so if you heard the end of that piece, then, as you say, that kind of gave it away. A few correct answers. Ross and Tainalt gets it right. Scott and Nadia from Bothwell and Lorna McGregor all kind of getting it along the right lines.
Yeah, there or thereabouts.
Yeah.
Apparently, they made a 24-minute recording of it, and it's based on one 24-hour period of sea traffic, so that's what the whales are having to put up with at the moment.
Yeah, a lot of noise.
That's it from us for today. Don't forget our New Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon, and our midweek podcast. Podcast published on Wednesday, which is this week's feature, a soundscape installation in Cray, Leerford and Fife. Until then, thanks for listening.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.